Now let us turn to the book of Psalms, Psalm 90 at verse 12, which is our text this evening. Psalm 90 at verse 12. So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. Now we know who the author of this psalm is. Normally, in all Bibles, the titles are printed, and you will probably have the title also printed in your own book, your own copy of the Bible. And it tells us that this is a prayer of Moses, the man of God. There are a number of men who composed the Psalms. It might be profitable for me to mention some of them. David wrote most of them and is referred to, therefore, as the sweet psalmist of Israel. But there are psalms written by others too. Asaph wrote some. Then there's Ethan, and you may notice that he wrote the previous one, number 89, Ethan the Ezraite. And then there's a writer, Heman. You notice that he is mentioned also as the author of number 88, two psalms back, a maskil of Heman the Ezraite. And possibly Solomon too wrote one of the Psalms of Degrees. The title says a psalm for Solomon, and it may be that that indeed is also a psalm by Solomon. But now this psalm, number 90, is written by Moses. And I do draw attention to that fact because it is of peculiar interest. It tells us immediately that Psalm 90 is the oldest of the Psalms. Moses was some 500 years earlier than David. So it is far and away the oldest psalm in the book, as far as our information goes. There is one theme that comes into this psalm again and again, and it runs all the way through. It is the theme of time. Allow me a moment just to show you how this theme recurs. Verse 1, Lord, thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations. The fathers, the children, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren, in all generations, God has been the dwelling place of his people. Verse 2, before the mountains were brought forth, or ever thou hast formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. So there again you see, everlasting, everlasting, everlasting. The thought of time is here. Verse 4, 1,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday when it is past, or as a watch in the night. See again the same emphasis upon time. We get it again in verse 6, in the morning it flourisheth and groweth up, in the evening it is cut down and withereth. So that is an estimate in the eyes of heaven as to the length of our life in this world. We're like the grass, he says. We grow in the morning and are cut down in the evening. Our little day, life's little day, that's the theme there. It comes in again a little later at verse 10. The days of our years are 70 years and 10. And if by reason of strength they be 80 years, yet is their strength labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off, and we fly away. Clearly that refers to the duration of a man's life, or the lifespan, as we call it, is 70 years, or in the case of some who are a bit healthier and stronger, perhaps 80, or a little bit more in some cases. One more verse, and that's verse 12, which is my text. In the light of all of that comes my text. So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. So what is in mind here is the thought that we need to make good use of the time God has given us here in this life. So that will be then the subject tonight. Teach us so to number our days that we may apply our hearts to wisdom. Now, time has been measured in all sorts of different ways throughout the centuries. It's an interesting thought. The ancient nations of Greece and Rome, they had sundials, of course, and that gave an idea as to the movement of time. They also had water clocks, things we don't, as far as I know, have anywhere in the world today. These water clocks had a sort of a bowl with a little hole in it, and they filled it with water to a certain level, and as the water dripped into a lower vessel, so they could count the amount of time which the water took to drip from the higher to the lower level. Now, we of course have all sorts of very clever modern devices for measuring time, but one of the most moving ways of measuring time, in my opinion, is the old hourglass. I'll tell you why I think so. It was like an egg timer. You had a higher and a lower chamber of glass, and it had a narrow neck between the two, and you turned it upside down, and slowly the sand moved from the upper to the lower part of the hourglass, and when it was all done, you know, an hour was done. These things used to be in pulpits in the days of John Knox, and when he had finished preaching for 1 hour, he would simply turn the glass over and start to preach for a second hour. That's the way they did it in those days. And I say that it's, to me, the most fascinating way to measure time, because it reminds us that time is flowing, always flowing on. It cannot be recovered. There's the clock on the wall, and its hands are always moving. They won't go backwards. Time cannot be reversed like a car. It's not so very long since we were looking at a calendar called 2006. We spent 365 or so days looking at that calendar. But now it's gone for good. It will never return while the world stands. It's gone, and it will not return. And so it is that the psalmist teaches us to pray this prayer. So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. That is to say, we have to learn to use time wisely. And we have to make good use of the time we have so that it is not wasted. You will know that, or perhaps you don't know, some of you, that it was the Puritans, our beloved spiritual fathers in the faith, who wrote the Westminster Confession in Scotland and in England. They loved one another. They weren't so concerned about which part of the British Isles they were born in. They loved one another. They shared a common religion. because it was the gospel that united our islands, Scotland, Wales, England, Ireland. It was the gospel that united us and made us one. And the Puritans, I say, were so concerned about the right use of time that it was they who invented clocks, I understand, that chime every quarter. We talk about the Westminster chimes. Well, I believe it was they, Puritans, who had such a lot of association with Westminster. In Westminster Confession and Westminster this and that, and that they wanted the people to learn to be so careful with their time that they decided every quarter of an hour they would have the clock reminding them of the passing of time, and so as to waste none of it as far as they possibly could. So it chimed every quarter. Well, that is all fully consistent with the teaching of my text. So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. Now, the first point of doctrine which clearly we draw out from this text must be this: God teaches us to value time in this life. God teaches us to value time and to make a good use of it, to regard our time as extremely precious. Now, we need to have this lesson, don't we? Because there is something in sinful man which would allow him to waste his time. This is one reason why I find it rather painful to walk through the streets of this town or any other town. I had to be in Edinburgh yesterday at a meeting to do with the Christian faith, and it was very distressing to see thousands and thousands of people. And although I'm not their judge, I have to say with sorrow, it was evident that the greater part of them were there completely wasting their time. The way they dressed, the way they looked, the way they behaved, it was obvious they had no conception, most of them, of the importance of time. So that is why this text is written. Teach us, Lord, teach us to number our days. Teach us to value our little bit of life, because there's not much of it that we're going to get. We're all apt to forget, aren't we, that we're only here once, we shall never come back, and our life is short. In the light of that, therefore, teach us, Lord, to use it well. It'll soon be over. And especially when we're young, alas, some of us, and I include myself, thoughtlessly wasted much time that might have been far better used. Let me quote you the case of a Roman general, Titus, became emperor once at Rome. And he had a Latin motto which I want to give you. If he didn't do anything useful in the course of any one day of his life, this is what he would say in Latin: perdidi diem. I have lost a whole day of life. Now, he was a pagan man. He was a heathen man, but he saw at least a little of what's meant in my text, although, of course, he didn't see it in a spiritual way. He didn't know how to use his time most fruitfully. But you can understand how he was a man who wanted to do something worthwhile in life. I have lost a whole day. Many Christian ministers have felt like that. Many Christian people have felt like that, both men and women. I have lost a whole day. And we shouldn't lose days, should we? We should make sure that we do something profitable in every day of life. As far as we have health and strength, we should aim that every day should be of some value to us or to others. Teach us so to number our days that we may apply our hearts unto others, unto wisdom. Now, Moses, I say, is the author of this psalm. And it is very appropriate, surely, that he should write in this way. Because Moses was the author of the book of Genesis. You will know that he wrote the Pentateuch, which consists of the first five books of the Old Testament. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. We call it the Pentateuch, of course. And Moses wrote it all. It's his work, inspired, of course, by the Holy Spirit, but he was the pen man of those wonderful books. And if you go to the very beginning of Genesis, say to chapter 5, you discover the ages of the antediluvian patriarchs, that is to say, the men who lived before the flood. And you know, without my telling you, roughly the ages of these men. These men like Methuselah, these men that lived before the flood, they lived to almost the age of 1,000. They had a far, far longer life than anyone did after the flood. I think what must have happened is that the climate and so on changed after the flood, and God, in his wisdom, he shortened the life of man. No doubt one of the reasons for that is because when sinners live a very long time and have their health and strength, they become 1,000 times wickeder through practice. A man who's a sinner and gets a long life, he learns to be not only wicked, but twice as wicked, and 10 times as wicked, and 100 times as wicked. No doubt that's what led to the flood. But every imagination of the thoughts of man's heart was only evil continually. So part of God's mercy to us all is he shortened the life of man. And Moses records that fact. So when you come to the post-diluvian patriarchs, those who lived after the flood, their lives are cut down considerably. Abraham was only 175. But then as we come to Moses' day, he was only 120. And when you come down to after Moses' day, God cut the span of man's life down to 70, roughly. 70 years sum up our life. And in the case of strong men and women, maybe 80, but not much more. So, that's only a fragment. That's only a tiny amount compared with what originally our forefathers had in the beginning of the world. And the less you have of a good thing, the better use you ought to make of it, surely. So that's why he prays this prayer. So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. Now that's one way in which Moses brings the subject before us, but it's not the only way. There's another way in which he presents to us the importance of time. And it is in contrasting man's life with God's life. And he begins with this. Thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations. And then he goes on. From everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. Now that's a very profound, wonderful, and to the Lord's people, comforting truth. The God whom we worship, the God whom we love and serve, if we are Christians, is a God who is everlasting, without beginning, without ending. His life goes on in serene, holy, eternal blessedness. Nothing can disturb the blessedness of God. Nothing can interrupt the happiness of God, the perfection of God. And in contrast with that, he looks at our life. And he puts it like this. We grow up like grass in the morning. In the morning we flourish and grow. It's like what happens in the springtime, isn't it? The grass appears dead throughout the winter. And then at a certain point, when the temperature reaches a certain level, suddenly the grass visibly begins to grow. Flowers appear on the earth again. Everything grows and grows. Ah, but how long does it last? The daffodils come out in March. How long do they last? 2 weeks or 3, and then they begin to fade and go. Now, there's something very sad about this song, isn't there? And there's something which worldly-minded people would not like about this song, because there's something cuts at the root of the happiness that the carnal worldly man has. He wants to enjoy life. He wants to enjoy this world. And he doesn't want to be told that his life is short and brief and soon to be gone. But my friends, the Bible from end to end is shot through with what I shall call serious wisdom. There is a sadness in the Bible. And that's because of sin and death and judgment and the grave. And it's only fools who do not allow these truths to have an important part in our thought life. And I'm afraid there's a great deal of foolishness, a great deal of folly in the world, that people would rather not know the truth concerning God's eternity and man's brief life. But if we're wise, we shall do what is said in my text. So teach us to number our days, that we shall apply our hearts unto wisdom. My friend, are you given to praying this prayer? Do you pray daily that you will live well and die well? Do you pray that God will prepare you for death and judgment and eternity? Well, you should. Every day you rise, you should pray that God will prepare you for all these things. Because if we come unprepared to any of these matters, death, judgment, eternity, then it will be our eternal undoing. That's the first thing. God teaches men to value time. Now, the second thing I bring you to is this. There is wisdom required to use our time aright. There is wisdom required to use our time aright. So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. There is something here that which I can only call reciprocal. That is to say, there are two factors interacting one with another. We need wisdom to use time aright, and then in the using of time aright, we are to seek wisdom. You see how the two things, as it were, are correlated, as we say. We need wisdom to use our life aright and our time aright. And the right use of time is to seek after wisdom. Only God can make us wise. And wisdom is a rare thing. Many live like fools, sadly, as though they were going to live forever and ever in this world. Whereas the Word of God tells us our days are few. Even Solomon, who was one of the wisest men who ever lived, said this: I said I would be wise, but it was far from me. Even Solomon admitted that to be wise is very hard. There is residual foolishness in us all. We can call it indwelling sin, but it is residual foolishness. It is residual stupidity that we don't apply our mind and heart and soul to the things which are biblically wise. Now, what is this wisdom? What does it consist of? Well, partly it is to value everything according to its true worth. Now, that is something which is rare. To value everything in life according to its true worth. In other words, wisdom consists in recognizing what is valuable as valuable and what is worthless as worthless. But that's very rare. Many, many people spend most of their life chasing the wind and pursuing the rainbow. This is what they do with lottery and with casino and with gambling. And there are millions doing it everywhere and rejoicing in it. But it is to chase the wind in the end. Because supposing we could become as rich as Solomon himself, if we're not wise, what are we the better for these earthly things? Supposing we could add house to house and garden to garden and bank account to bank account, you can only wear one suit of clothes at a time. Your stomach's only big enough to hold one meal at a time. Supposing you're the richest person in the northern hemisphere, you can only wear one tie at a time, or put one hat on your head at a time. And people live as though to gain more and more and more of this world is the great desire and the great ambition. Let me tell you about an ancient king. His name was King Croesus. He was king of Lydia in the time of the Greeks. And the legend is told, I don't think it's history, I think it's legend. The legend is told that this very rich king once entertained a Greek philosopher called Solon. Solon was a wise man in his own way. And the king turned to Solon, the philosopher, and said to him, "Who, sir, is the who is the happiest man in the world?" He was hoping that Solon would say it was King Croesus himself. And the philosopher refused to answer. And the question was put to him again and again. And Solon refused to answer. And then when he was pressed, he said, "O King Croesus," he said, "I have learned to call no man happy until he is dead." And King Croesus didn't like that. He felt insulted. But time changed. The day came when he himself, as the king, was beaten in battle and captured. And his enemy, Cyrus II, placed him on a funeral pyre to burn him to death. And when he was on top of the funeral pyre, Croesus remembered these words of Solon: "Call no man happy till he's dead." And he started to weep. And the king who had conquered him, Cyrus II, he said, "Ask him why he's weeping before we burn him to death." And he told this story. And Cyrus was so touched, he allowed the man to escape with his life. You see the wisdom of that. Call no man happy till he's dead. There is wisdom in that. We don't know what's going to happen to us in this life. We had better not boast about anything. "Let not the rich man boast in his riches," says the Bible. "Let not the mighty man boast in his might, nor the wise man boast in his wisdom. Let him that boasteth," said God, "boast in this, that he knows and understands that I am God." Now that's what's meant by numbering our days and applying our heart unto wisdom. Now, how does all this relate then to the use of time? Well, like this. We should spend our hours and days becoming wiser with the knowledge of God. Wiser with the knowledge of the Bible. Bible knowledge. Growing in grace and understanding of the things of God. Listen to what the Bible says. "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all thy getting, get understanding." When I was a young student studying university degrees, many years ago now, I used to sit in Manchester Central Reading Library. I mention that because there's a beautiful dome on the top of the library in Manchester. And all round the dome on the inside are those very words. "Wisdom is the principal thing, therefore get wisdom, and with all thy getting, get understanding." You see, whoever designed that building, at least he had a notional realization of the importance of the Bible. How many students noticed those words or paid any attention, I've no idea. But by the grace of God, I did, because I was a Christian and I saw how wise that is. How wise that is. Now, what's meant then in using our time in the best way? Well, it is this. It is to try to do something profitable every day of life. To learn a little more. Now, that will vary with the capacity and the gift of every man and woman. Some people have a marvelous ability for learning. And some of us don't. Most of us are pretty pedestrian. Very few of us are geniuses. But we are to use the gift we have to acquire a little bit more each day. You know how to get a good collection of stamps, I'll tell you. To get a good collection of stamps, all you need to do is a pair of scissors, and every day, cut off the stamps that come to your house. Maybe one or two is all you get, or three. But take them off every day and put them in a drawer. And after 10 years, you'll have a large number of stamps, maybe well over 1,000. And all you've done is clip off one each day or two. Now that's what we're to do with knowledge. You're to get a little bit of knowledge more and more and more each day, consciously, deliberately aiming to improve in our knowledge of the Bible, our knowledge of how to please God, our knowledge of how to live to the glory of God. That's what it means. That whatever we do, we must aim to do it with the glory of God in mind. Aiming at a purposeful life. You know the old saying, if you aim at nothing, you're sure to hit it. And that's so true. Let me give you an example of this. Of course, I'm talking about a man of genius when I say this, but it is interesting. Principal John MacLeod of the Free Church College, who was before that a young minister in the Free North, Principal John MacLeod, he had a photographic memory. Whatever he read, he remembered. It's extremely rare. He knew the whole Bible off by heart. So if he needed to quote anything, he would just do it off the back of his head. Somebody challenged him and said, can you quote the whole Bible? Yes, more or less, he said. So they said, all right, do it. And he did it. He made a few mistakes, I think, with some of the names in First Chronicles, which you appreciate is very difficult to remember, but he knew it. And he was like that with the books. If you were arguing with him, he would say, well, it's in the 25th book on your shelf, page 174, paragraph 3, there's your answer. He could do that. He couldn't forget. But you see, he used his gift to learn and learn and learn and study the things of God. No one could beat him in Greek at university. He would have been Greek professor, except that he decided to go in for theology. The Greek professor who followed admitted it. If John MacLeod had gone in for Greek, I wouldn't be here, he said. You see, he used his gift. Let me tell you of an American man, Robert Dick Wilson. Now, Robert Dick Wilson was, again, a very brilliant man. About the age of 25, he sat down and thought about his future life. And he realized that if he lived roughly as long as his father and grandfather, which was quite possible, that he would live another, say, 45 years. So this is what he did. He said, if I live 45 years more, I'll spend a third of that time, 15 years, studying all the ancient languages in which the Bible is written. I'll spend the next 15 years studying all the versions that can be found of the Bible in those languages. And the third 15 years I shall spend writing books to tell the Lord's people how reliable their Bible is. He did this because the Bible was under attack from higher critics and liberals, and those who were infidels in their attitude to the Word of God. So he did that. And he became an expert in 45 ancient languages. You can smile, couldn't you? 45 ancient languages. Hebrew, Aramaic, all these other languages. We may know the names and nothing more. And all the languages in which the ancient scriptures have been translated, he could read them. And he said to the Bible critics, he said, if you find a Bible in any version that I can't read, tell me, and I'll learn that language so as to understand the reliability of the Bible in that language. And that's what he did, and wrote his great book. He was in Princeton University, or Princeton Theological Seminary. Great, great man. Now you see, what a purposeful life that was. Now, you and I couldn't do that, probably, or very few of us here could do that. Maybe one or two good, but certainly most of us couldn't. God hasn't endowed us with that kind of gift, but my dear friend, according to the gifts we have, we are to add a little bit more and a little bit more. The principle is to use our time to gather wisdom. To gather wisdom. Teach us so to number our days that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. That's what he's talking about here. Living the Christian life to the glory and honor of God. Using our tongues so as to edify one another. If I was ever the dictator of this country, which is not likely, I think I would introduce a new law that we mustn't talk about the weather more than for 10 seconds a day. We've got a terrible national habit. We're always talking about the weather. And we would be far better to spend that time talking about a text of the Bible. When we gather together, talk about the things of God. When we meet together, encourage one another in the things of God. And it's all a question of this wisdom, you see. Learning more wisdom. And the effect of this wisdom will be, it will lift us to a higher and higher appreciation of the glory of God. That's what Moses is interested to do. And that's how he ends this psalm. Oh, satisfy us early with thy mercy. Make us glad, he said. Let thy work appear to thy servants and thy glory to their children. And let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us. The work of our hands, establish thou it. Yea, establish thou it. Oh, revive thy work. Pour out thy spirit. Glorify thy name. Build up thy church. Fill assemblies of thy people with worshippers. That's really what he means in other words. And if we all applied our hearts to wisdom in the way he says, my dear friends, who knows what we might begin to see God doing as he sees the seriousness with which we take his word. Well, I must close. Let me do so briefly. This wisdom needs to be seen in every part of life, especially in our thoughts. Oh, how we need this divine grace to think as we ought to think. If you're like me, and I hope you're not, but if you're like me, you find your thoughts begin well. You begin with God, and then you go down and down and down. And then you think, oh, I wake up, and then think, oh, may God forgive me. My thoughts will come from heaven, and I'm now groveling on the earth again, as usual. Lord, lift up my thoughts to heaven again. I'll never forget an experience I had on a train once, traveling in the Highlands. There were some young men from England going through the Highlands on a holiday. And I was, it was through the night, and I was trying to sleep. And these young men were talking, which was forgivable. But their conversation began with decency, shall I say. But after half an hour, it began to be questionable. And after another half hour, it was downright rotten. So I shook my head and I said to these young men, would you please change your subject of conversation? Lift your conversation up. They got a shock, but they did it. They were silent at least. You see, my friends, it's true of all of us as sinners. Our thoughts come down and down and down. We need to have our thoughts lifted up to God. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. Oh, teach us, Lord, to number our days that we may apply our hearts to wisdom, to be wise men and women. What an honor it would be, what an honor it is for any minister when people think of his congregation as being wise men and women, wise young people, wise children, numbering their days, striving to achieve something for God in this world. We're not aiming at our own glory. We don't want to see our own name in neon lights or on headlines of newspapers. Our interest is not in ourselves, but in him, his glory, his truth, his kingdom, revival of his work in the world. Let me close with a story which always touches me. You will know of Adam Bede of Jarrow, Newcastle-on-Tyne, where lived in the, would it be the 9th century, I think, early in the 9th century. He was an extremely learned man. He was not free from the superstition and errors of his day, I have to add, but he was a very, very learned man. Spent all this time as a monk in Jarrow, learning Latin and Greek and Hebrew and medicine, as far as they had any medicine in those days, and so on. He spent his time in learning and wrote important books and things. But at the end of his life, his concern was to translate the Gospel of John into Anglo-Saxon. That's the language before English developed in its modern form. Very touching story. He was now dying, frail, and he had an amanuensis, or a scribe, who was dictating to, and the scribe was writing the translation that he made into Anglo-Saxon. And towards the end, chapter 19, the strength of Bede was failing. Go on, he said, go on. I want strength to finish, he said, go on. So Bede dictated a bit more. Chapter 20, dictated a bit more. And he fell back on his bed, gasping. One more chapter to go, he said, go on. And he dictated and finished translating the whole of the Gospel of John. When that was the end of his life's work, he'd numbered his days. He'd applied his heart unto wisdom. He died translating the Holy Scriptures so that the people of this nation at that time would be able to read of the wonderful works of God and of Jesus Christ. That's what makes missionaries. That's what sends people all over the world to serve Christ. Dear friend, make this your daily prayer. So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom.